And when we talked earlier about the caliber of competition making their way to the Central States, this is one of the men we're talking about, the Mad Dog himself, Buzz Sawyer, who's had more than his share of troubles with several wrestlers here in the Central States. He's been involved in a bitter, bitter feud with one Crazy Luke Graham.
From Television City in Hollywood,
this podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown as taped in front of a live studio audience.
Stand by, St. Louis, for action. You've got a ringside seat for the action and excitement of professional wrestling. This is KDNL-TV All-Star Wrestling.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 132 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winson, and today I'm going to be taking a look at a territory I've never looked at before. As the song goes, I'm going to Kansas City, here I come. And that's, I have not recorded my version of that song, although it was covered like a trillion times and just researching the history of it. Yes, looking at the Central States promotion out of Kansas City from March 10th, 1984. Very important territory within the National Wrestling Alliance, although it was debatable by the time 1984 rolled around just how relevant they were. It's a different kind of show. There's not a whole lot of glitz and glamour, but then again, there wasn't a whole lot of that in 1984 in a lot of the territories anyway. So before I get into all that, but first, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter at GFAllentownPod. That is at GFAllentownPod. And you may be listening to this show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. And I'd like to tell you that Pro Wrestling Only, the feed, that is having its annual fundraising drive for the SoundCloud feed on which you can hear this show. And you can PayPal to Kelly Nelson at kellyn@uvic.ca. The goal, I believe, is $75 or $80, whatever the SoundCloud is for the year to maintain the feed. So if you like the show, a dollar will help, $2 will help, and all we'd really need is about 30 people donating $2, and I think we'll be over that goal. The last I saw is about $47 to go. I'll be sending in my donation since I am part of the feed, and let's just say it's the right thing to do, even though my unemployment hasn't come in. But I'm sure I can forego a coffee or something to that effect going forward. So please do that if you get a chance. Now, as why would I choose Kansas City? Well, I think part of it is, number one, this show was requested by a friend of mine in Kansas City when I started doing this podcast, and I put it off as long as humanly possible. And I do consult people about the shows that I'm going to be doing. In fact, I put something up on Twitter the other day about an August 1991 WWF show. Which one would you prefer that I do between the primetime wrestling with the Macho Man's Bachelor Party before the match made in heaven at SummerSlam, or the SummerSlam Spectacular, which aired 8 days before that pay-per-view event? And I was out on a boat with Keithy last weekend for a friend's birthday, which was funny because it was actually Keith's birthday, but it was for somebody else's birthday party. And I was asking him, but Keithy, you know, I called him Johnny 12 Tokes a couple of weeks ago for some of his vaping actions. And he was doing that thing where he's like, I'm not going to vape until I see somebody else do it first. And then you get into this weird Alamo standoff where anybody who wants to vape is waiting for the person to actually do it first. And anyway, that's fine. But I could tell that maybe he had taken too many tokes of it later. It was only a 2-hour tour, so we avoided the Gilligan's Island thing. And in that 2 hours, near the end, he said something to the effect of, you should do a show from the lead up to Halloween Havoc 1991, because WCW was really good. And it was at that point that I knew that he was officially high, because, well, it doesn't become good until Rick Rude comes in. That's kind of the point where things start to turn around. But it's a good weekend overall. I got to go to the Lowell Spinners, although I missed WWE night on Tuesday, which had an appearance by Mojo Rawley. It had been postponed because the game was rained out 2 weeks earlier, so I guess Mojo's going to come back for that. I guess SmackDown Live doesn't need him. I haven't seen him on television in quite a while, but you know, his pal Rob Gronkowski announced that the next thing in his career is he's going to be doing the, not THC, but the other thing, COD, CED. I really don't know much about it. And I guess pain management, all that sort of stuff. So, I don't know. Maybe I will do a 1991 WCW show at some point. It has been a while. I think it was like episode 74 the last time I did that. I also found out that I may be going to Alaska at the end of September. Now, that means I would have to find Alaska Championship Wrestling. Actually, no, I did a quick look into the history of pro wrestling in Alaska. Apparently, somebody ran cards up there in 2001 that had Justin Credible, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, and a few other familiar names. But obviously, it's not the greatest territory in the world. I mean, you think Stampede getting around there? At least there's roads. Here, you'd probably have to take, like, up in Alaska, you'd have to take ferries. So, probably nothing like that, but we shall see going down the road. I do hope to, maybe in September, be able to go back and do two shows in a week, but sometimes for something like Kansas City, it requires a little bit more research, since this is something that I don't watch particularly regularly. In fact, this may have been the first time I've actually sat down and watched a full episode from start to finish that wasn't just a Harley Race promo, which, by the way, if you're waiting for any Harley Race stuff on this show, you could probably tune out now, because yes, I picked the one Central States show from between 1971 and 1985 that doesn't have a Harley Race promo or match in it. But, oh well, them's the breaks. But Kansas City, longtime member of the National Wrestling Alliance. And it was a very important area for a long time, despite when you listen to Ric Flair on his various podcasts, he kind of put it down, because it wasn't the best paying area, and when he would come in, he wouldn't have the greatest opponents in the world. I mean, Rufus R. Jones, popular guy in that area, but not particularly highly regarded outside of that territory. But they did have Harley Race, who kind of went between Kansas City and St. Louis. I think he's more associated with Kansas City, and St. Louis was sort of like a sibling territory for the Kansas City promotion. This video, in fact, was off of a St. Louis television station where there was a war going on, as I've gone over in previous episodes. The WWF Wrestling at the Chase had started up early in 1984. So the St. Louis-Kansas City overlapped, only a four and a half hour trip across I-70 across the state of Missouri. And they had lost a lot of ground, the Kansas City side did, in the mid-80s, which kind of coincides with Harley Race losing the NWA title at the first Starrcade to Ric Flair, which is only about 4 or 5 months before this. So you get kind of the center of power goes from Kansas City and St. Louis over to Jim Crockett Promotions, even though Flair had an earlier run with the belt between 81 and 83. That's why that match is generally regarded as a changing of the guard. So Kansas City is starting to fall behind, but just a brief history of the territory, the Central States as it was known, or Kansas City, or as Adam Clayton from U2 called it, the City of Kansas, which, if you listen to Sirius Satellite Radio, they had a U2 channel over the summer, and they do the thing where Bono says something pretentious between songs and kind of tells a story, but there was one where Adam Clayton talked about when they were in Kansas City, but referred to it as the City of Kansas, the only person ever I've heard that has called it that. And the territory dates to July of 1948. It was known as the Midwest Wrestling Association. It may have actually gone a little bit before that. I read kind of conflicting things. But later, 1948, an important year in wrestling. That's when the National Wrestling Alliance was formed. And two founders of the NWA were involved in Central States in Kansas City, Orville Brown and Paul George, who was born in Lowell and is not the guy from the Oklahoma City Thunder who shot his way out of town and ended up in with the Clippers because of the whole Kawhi Leonard thing. The territory encompassed Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, and also Missouri as well. Like I said, it stretched all the way across the state to St. Louis. And in 1958, so a decade later, a consortium, there's that word that we'd hear 4 decades after that, of Bob Geigel, Harley Race, and Pat O'Connor took over the territory, with Geigel as sort of the lead guy, having Harley Race and Pat O'Connor there, two legendary, Harley Race would become a legendary figure in wrestling after that. In 1958, he was definitely not yet to that point. They formed the Heart of America Sports Promotions, and Geigel was on the NWA board and actually served as chairman in the late 70s and into the 1980s. But the big break for Central States was when Harley Race would finally win the NWA world title, kind of by accident, almost as a transitional champion to get the belt from Dory Funk Jr. to Jack Briscoe. This is in 1973, but definitely put Central States on the map, even just kind of a brief title reign. And they struggled, just like a lot of other territories, as you get into the 1980s with the WWF expansion. They came right into the territory, and the famous story of Harley Race confronting Hulk Hogan in the locker room with a gun or whatever the hell that was. They kind of lacked star power, in part because it was not the best-paying territory. Bob Geigel might not have had the best reputation as being the best promoter, especially compared with other guys like a Paul Bosch in Houston. But Kansas City is certainly a great city. I mean, I love to go there, but if I'm a professional wrestler in the year 1985 and 86, maybe I don't want to go there unless I want to wrestle somebody like Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty, who teamed up for the first time in that territory. When 1986 rolls around, they sell the promotion to Jim Crockett Promotions. Another one of those, why would Crockett buy something that was about to probably go out of business anyway? And in fact, to make the story even weirder, Bob Geigel bought the territory back from JCP in 1987, which just seems even more asinine, and left the NWA and started a new promotion called the WWA, which closed in 1989, like a couple of other territories did, like World Class goes under or merges into the USWA. Continental goes under in 1989, kind of a watershed year in pro wrestling. So at this point in time, in early 1984 Central States, who are our names in the territory other than Harley Race? Well, let me tell you, let's start with the champions in Central States at this time. The territory's champion was Buzz Tyler, who's in his third reign out of four that he'd eventually have. We actually don't see him on this show, even as a promo or whatever. The tag team titles they were currently vacant. This is not the biggest tag team territory in the world. I mean, they did have tag team titles, but it just happened to be at this point, they were vacant. The television champion is Colonel Buck Robley, who is about to leave, and then the title would become vacant. So not the greatest sign for your territory going forward when you have so many titles that just are vacant. We actually do see Robley on this show, and we're going to meet a lot of other new faces to Greetings from Allentown. And Ted Oates, Crazy Luke Graham, T.G. Stone, and we also, because apparently they needed to fill out the program, we're going to take a visit down to World Class Championship Wrestling, but not what is going on at that moment, although right at the top of the show they allude to the recent passing of David Von Erich, but we're going to get a taped match from 1982 with Kerry Von Erich facing off against Killer Tim Brooks, and I was kind of delighted to see that. I mean, I know this is the Kansas City show, and I should be focusing on that. And as I sit at my table recording this right now, those damn turkeys have appeared in my yard again, and I'm probably going to have to go outside and clap at them, although they appear to be walking away right now. There's the one adult turkey, and then there are the 4 smaller ones, and they're getting bigger by the day. So I'm a little concerned. They confronted me in the driveway. I mean, this is going to be a war. This is 5-1 here. I feel like Razor Ramon at that Survivor Series. I think it was 94. Maybe they'll all get counted out at some point. Anyway, enough about all that. So without any further ado, why don't we just jump right into this look at Central States from March 1984.
Ursay reportedly has scheduled a second meeting with Phoenix officials as he continues to explore possibilities for the move of his franchise. Now, of course, all systems are go for the Colts to come to Indy and play in the brand-new Hoosier Dome, but Ursay has not indicated his intention.
It would be March of 1984 when Bob Ursay would pull the Colts out of Baltimore in the middle of the night using Mayflower moving trucks, going to Indianapolis, and it was done because the state of Maryland had threatened to eminent domain the team from him. So I think the lesson there is don't invoke eminent domain for, you know, unjust purposes. It's to, you know, build a highway or a school or something to that effect. But yeah, the Colts almost moved to Phoenix. I mean, if that negotiation had been allowed to play out a little bit more, who knows? And then maybe the St. Louis Cardinals move someplace different. I don't know. The NFL is just so weird. It's just the various cities throwing money at these owners to come to their city. It's one of those things that's a little perverse when you think about it. So we go to our telecast, and right at the start, we meet Rick Stewart, who leads us off here. He would usually do these with Kevin Wall, who eventually would go on to become a talk radio guy who bounced around all over the place. It seemed to be a right-of-center talk radio guy. Then again, not too many left-of-center talk radio personalities. It seems to be a medium more befitting a right-wing commentator. So Rick Stewart is here, and he's not that bad. He leads off by talking about now all the pressure, and it seems a little weird because the Von Erichs are down in Texas, but let us not forget the WWF tolled the bell for David Von Erich at the Allentown taping, the first one that they had after his death. So clearly the Von Erichs held power within the greater wrestling community, and it was a very sad event when David ended up passing. So Stewart's going to tell us a little bit about Kerry Von Erich before we throw it to a taped match from Texas from a year and a half ago.
And with the recent tragic death of David Von Erich, it seems that the load of the Von Erich family has fallen on the shoulders of the modern-day warrior, Kerry Von Erich, who in himself is a world-class competitor and one of the top contenders for the world's heavyweight championship.
Hearing that kind of made me wonder, why does it all have to fall on him? Because isn't Kevin there too? And I know Kevin seemed to be a little bit more reticent about traveling to other territories. So basically, not somebody that would be cut out to be the NWA world champion that Fritz had always dreamed for one of his kids. And it gave me the thought of, well, did they, by pushing Kerry into this and, you know, towards this world title track at that point, could that have eventually led to some of his problems? And then honestly, in considering it, it didn't make a damn bit of difference because I think things were going down a certain path. Obviously, the motorcycle accident changed everything from Kerry's perspective, but there's a reason why the family was beset by tragedies because, you know, just certain things were happening, and I'm not sure all of it was by accident. I mean, perhaps there's a mental health issue that I am definitely not qualified to sort of address. So the match from late 1982 is Kerry Von Erich taking on Killer Tim Brooks, and Kerry does not come out to his usual Tom Sawyer, you know, that's where you get the name, Modern Day Warrior, but instead is coming out to the song Can't Get Loose by Sammy Hagar, a rather interesting choice. But the thing that's amusing to me as Kerry is coming to the ring, you come through the crowd in the Sportatorium, or I'm not sure if this is Fort Worth or the Sportatorium. It could be one of the two. Maybe my mind's just playing tricks on me like a ghetto boy or something. But Kerry is getting mobbed by the fans as he comes through. And I'm sorry that I'm laughing because when he gets to ringside, a girl kind of stands in front of him. And then, no lie, Kerry starts, like, making out with her for a good 7 seconds. It's so hilarious. And this one kid, probably like a 10-year-old boy, like, kind of jumps in front like, hey, what's this? Can I get a piece of this action? It's so damn funny. And Kerry, by the way, of course, also looks high as a kite on his way down. And I'm talking a level where the girl that he's making out with, that she could potentially just get a contact high from kissing him for 7 seconds. And you're probably wondering, how do I know that this match is from late 1982? And you could say, well, you looked up Kerry Von Erich versus Killer Tim Brooks. They had two matches later in 1982 on World Class Television. Well, that would be one way to do it. But the other way, the staple of mid to late 1982 World Class Championship Wrestling, my hero and yours is back on color commentary, Dallas Cowboys backup tight end, Jay Saldi, the star of episode 108 of Greetings from Allentown. He is back, and he is back big.
Shorty's going to tire Bill, excuse me, but he had great conditioning program, had a great rehab program. We're glad to see him back in the ring. He is the man that held the Texas title longer than any other wrestler in the history of the state there.
There is nobody, and I am talking from any era, the year 2019, 1982, however you want to do it, who can recite something that he saw in a wrestling magazine better than Jay Saldi. Does he come off as a 10-year-old overly anxious to tell you what he has just learned? Of course he does, but truth be told, he actually did get a little bit better towards the end, working with Bill Mercer, who's no great shakes as a play-by-play guy, but, you know, he did the best he could. And they were trying to one-up each other in that one world-class episode that I did quite a bit ago. Killer Tim Brooks, that is who they were referring to as he was coming back from some sort of injury. And as Mark Lorenz, the ring announcer, tries to get out the weight and where everybody is from, the Kerry and Brooks are going at it. And Lorenz just kind of keeps going as he's walking out of the ring. So, you know, gotta get it in there. I wrote in my notes that this appeared to be Fort Worth, and I don't know what I'm basing that on, because I haven't watched too much World Class on the network with WorldCast being on hiatus, so maybe it's just kind of out of my mind or whatever. Flying head scissors by Kerry, who, by the way, still has his robe on as he does it. So that is actually pretty impressive. I mean, Kerry was a pretty athletic wrestler to the, you know, point where he lost the damn foot because of the motorcycle accident, and then trying to come back on it too soon, which is another thing you can probably pin on that whole family dynamic you have. But Saldi, did I choose this episode because I knew that there would be a little slice of Jay Saldi in Central States Wrestling to liven this thing up? Yes, I confess, all right? If you're going to charge me with a crime here, I'm going to plead nolo contendere, okay? But Saldi, even in 1982, there's discussion of Kerry Von Erich in the NWA world title.
Had a couple chances too, Bill, but it's been literally robbed of the title. Ric Flair one time ended up in disqualification, another time the referee's involvement. You know, just so many times that this young man, Kerry Von Erich, has fell short of the title, but the way he looks now, it's in his grasp.
Did he say in his grasp or in his grass? Because I think either one could be true. Now, if this is November of 1982, this is before the famous cage match with Michael Hayes as the referee that kicks off the Freebirds Von Erich feud that's going to carry them basically through the middle of 1984. It still hasn't really even ended yet by this point. And Kerry had had a screwy finish with Flair shortly before that anyway, so it was something that was an ongoing concern, and perhaps a signal that Kerry would be the one to have an NWA world title reign, when it's been generally presumed that David would have been the one, given that he was much better positioned for that, and because he could go and be a heel in the various territories. But it's really hard to imagine any of the Von Erichs having a reign beyond the 18 days or so that Kerry did, because that would require Jim Crockett Promotions to kind of relinquish the control that they had just really sort of consolidated over that title. I haven't said anything much about Killer Tim Brooks, but it bothers me that his boots say KB and not TB. Although, I don't know, maybe his real first name was Killer, and his name is actually Killer Brooks, and Tim is his middle name. A side headlock by Brooks, and Kerry actually powers out of it by kind of grabbing the hands. And I guess that's a different way to do it, but Brooks ends up grabbing Kerry's luscious mane of hair. I don't think that really gets talked about with Kerry. Sure, we can just talk about the fact that he was missing a foot after a while, but he did have a hell of a head of hair, I have to admit. That Saldi is hoping that a future world title match between Kerry Von Erich and Ric Flair might be in Dallas.
Well, we all hope here that it's right here in Dallas, Texas, where it should be on Kerry's home turf.
And that's exactly what it would be when Kerry would win the title in May of 1984. But I was thinking about the whole concept of the traveling NWA champion, which started to be phased out, and by 1986, it's almost entirely exclusive to Jim Crockett Promotions. But the funny thing is, like, trying to think of something that is comparable to elsewhere in the world of sports, and it's pretty much the Harlem Globetrotters model, where you don't see them play the Generals in their home arena in Harlem, New York, because there's no such venue. They basically just play all road games. So Ric Flair, Jack Briscoe, Dory Funk, what have you. Yeah, sure, they might have a few matches in their home territory, but the whole concept of the traveling NWA champion is to go into these various towns and basically play the road game, so to speak. So yes, the NWA champion is the Harlem Globetrotters of the professional wrestling world. Now, Kerry can't shake the headlock or the chin lock that Brooks has on him. I'm wondering why that is, but Saldi lets us know that Brooks had a successful tour of San Antonio teaming with Hacksaw Dugan. I don't know what I liked more, the fact that he called him Dugan, which Bill Watts would also do, but Jay Saldi referred to everything as a successful tour. It didn't matter if it was someplace as close as San Antonio or Captain Frank Dusick going to Japan and having a 2-14 record in like all Japan and some tour. Like, oh yeah, it was a successful tour of Japan. I just really kind of love that stuff. Kerry gets tossed to the outside, and he is allowed a moment to regroup, but when he gets back up on the apron, Brooks comes over, and he kind of gets low-bridged or tripped by Kerry somehow, who then tries to take advantage of it with a slingshot splash on the way in, but Brooks gets the knees up. This allows Brooks to go for a splash of his own, but Kerry ends up getting the knees up on that, and as Brooks is hunched over towards the corner of the ring, he wanders out just enough where Kerry scores with a sunset flip. Not particularly good looking, because sunset flip, you're supposed to go kind of over the top of the guy's head, and Kerry kind of went three quarters, but isn't that just the Kerry Von Erich way? Something's just a little bit off, perhaps due to marijuana or something to that effect. But that three quarters sunset flip finishes off this bout from World Class Championship Wrestling. So it's nice to see Kerry from 1982, despite all my jokes. I mean, I'm pretty sure he's going to now go bang that girl that he was making out with earlier. Don't worry, I'm sure she's probably down for it. It's probably, she has one of those relationships with her mother, like the one in Mean Girls who has Amy Poehler as the mother, who's, it's just kind of setting up the makeout den so that Kerry can come over and, you know, have his way with the daughter.
Programming simple.
Sure.
Try it this way.
Now, command the powers of Adam, the complete 80K computer system all in one package.
I got it.
What if I forget it?
Take it home with you.
Adam, let's call it 1000.
Other systems do. With them, word processor, extra. Printer, extra. Memory drives, extra.
And Adam?
All included.
Adam,
put up my time travel program.
Uh-oh.
Command the powers of Adam and program your future.
Ah, she's a beauty. You can't beat a Coleco, eh?
The Coleco Adam came out in 83, which pretty much like everything with computers and home video game systems, 83 was a particularly terrible year, and the Adam was a failure for Coleco. I think they lost something like $45 million over a couple of years, mainly due to that because it just didn't work as advertised. And also, Gil from The Simpsons, who I played the drop there, would like, kind of put you down for a Coleco. Maybe my least favorite Simpsons character of all time. He's just so pointless. And you start seeing him the second Phil Hartman dies. Like, oh, so this is going to replace Lionel Hutz and all the other characters? Like, give me a break. Now up next, in our first match proper from Memorial Hall in Kansas City, Kansas, which I only learned recently that it was actually in the Kansas side. And most everything is on the Missouri side, the downtown and all that stuff. And Ted Oates taking on Bill Howard. And Oates is a longtime veteran of the Central States Territory in a tag team with his brother Jerry, in so much as there was a viable tag team division in Kansas City. He was also part later in the mid-80s, shortly after this, I think later in 84, the Hollywood Blondes, one of the various versions of that, Ted Oates teaming with Rip Rogers. And for his part, Howard is just kind of your classic enhancement talent who worked in pretty much all of the territories. But he looks very much like a creature of the 1970s, like he's dropped out of some sort of 1972 time warp and is here in 1984 Kansas City. Oates is the babyface, which I'm learning this as I'm watching this because I just don't really know the particulars of who these people are. Stewart says that Oates had just made his return from the Deep South territory, and he was a fixture around various southern territories, but he stupidly does not get his jacket off before Howard ends up attacking him, and he hits a backdrop, but then Oates fires up back and hits a backdrop of his own. The announcer says hi to a few. They would do this on Mid-South also, where Jim Ross would shout out a TV station somewhere, I think maybe to flatter the executives. But Rick Stewart wants to say hi to all of his pals out in Wichita. I'd
like to take a special time out now to say hello to my friends in Wichita, Kansas, that watch us every week on Multimedia Cable Systems Channel 33. Get a chance to go down to Wichita every once in a while. They've got some tremendous wrestling, some tremendous fans down there, and some of the hottest action in the Central States.
I think he's saying hi to Owen and his dad, Gus, who's the proprietor of the Braidwood Inn out in Wichita. Best shower curtain rings in the entire Central States territory.
Well, welcome to Wichita.
That motel from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles was in the news earlier this year for being the site of a prostitution bust and drug overdoses. Believe me, this is far more interesting than Ted Oates versus Bill Howard. It's actually in Braidwood, Illinois, so it's not in Wichita, Kansas. Property is now called the Sun Motel and is under different ownership than it was when it was filmed there in the 1980s, that movie. This is from WGNTV.com. Braidwood police received assistance from several other jurisdictions and even recruited police retirees for this bust. Gee, funny how that always seems to happen with these sex stings and prostitution busts. An undercover officer posed as a pimp from Chicago looking for a location for his illicit business. An undercover female officer posed as a prostitute, and retired members of law enforcement play the role of Johns. Police say court-authorized recordings captured motel owner Vinny Patel acknowledging that he knew prostitution was being conducted at the property. I think this was a storyline on Schitt's Creek in season 2 or 3 or whatever the hell season I'm on in watching it. The ring is not well lit. That's my other complaint about this. I don't know if that's a function of the promotion, which I think it is, or of Memorial Hall in Kansas City just being that way. A slap by Oates. As the two men were down on their knees, Oates just kind of lays a slap on. That was actually pretty funny. And outside the ring, when Howard ends up at ringside, somebody walks up to him and just yells in his ears. That was kind of humorous as well, because people are just walking around ringside willy-nilly during this entire card. I talked on the Place to Be podcast about how, oh, there's no security at the ringside table. People just steal the belts. Like, here, I feel like you could almost run in the ring a la the Backlund thing that I covered on last week's show. Go Ted, go chant by the crowd as they're stalling and nobody is actually going anywhere until they fight on the outside for a little bit. A JYD-style headbutt by Oates, who was down on all fours inside the ring, and he gets to Howard, who was just outside. But Howard then grabs a leg and sort of throws it into the post to try and work on the inside of the knee. But then back inside, he misses a knee off the second rope, and you can see that this thing is going to be winding up very soon. A spinning toehold finishes for Ted Oates. This was fine, but when I'm looking for other stuff desperately to talk about, I don't know if this is the greatest. It was fine. It was a professional wrestling match conducted in the mid-80s, which I suppose qualifies it for this program.
Glenn, may I respond to that?
Well, we'll come back to you.
What's new about coming out for entrepreneurs? You know, when I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Yeah.
Kind of got the feeling that the Democrats were in trouble back in 84 when they're using Where's the Beef to get babyface pops in the debate, which Walter Mondale did against Gary Hart, who, of course, shares the name with a professional wrestling manager, but he's much more famous for getting busted with a mistress in 87, 88 after daring the press to try and catch him in the act. It really affected the way media covers campaigns. But that's a long story for another time, and how Gary Hart and that whole thing. He's from Colorado, so no relation to the Gary Hart, the manager from World Class and WCW 1989 and 90. But one man that he did manage in WCW during that time was Mad Dog Buzz Sawyer, who was known as Bulldog Buzz Sawyer not long after this, when he would appear in the WWF. And here he is between stints in Georgia Championship Wrestling and the WWF, which blew my mind, because when I was doing my watch through of 84 WWF, when those were all on YouTube back in the summer of 2016, seeing him in that environment was just so weird and out of context. It's sort of like the way people would talk about Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard. Oh, it didn't make sense that they were in the WWF. I vehemently disagree with that, because they desperately needed some diversity in the WWF. But seeing Sawyer in the WWF, even in 1984, he's one of those guys that showed up for a little bit and left. But that was just his way. He would show up in places, and sometimes he would be there for quite a while, like in World Class in 86, be an integral part of things, or in Georgia before this period of time in 83, most famous being the last Battle of Atlanta with Tommy Rich. But he's a guy that just fascinates me every single time I see him, because I learn something new about him every time, you know, I see him in the ring, which is nice, because you really can't sit here and think, oh, well, I absolutely know it all about every single person in wrestling. It's one of the things in my journey that I like it after, you know, 4 or 5 years of watching this again and having access to so much more stuff to learn new things. Now, Sawyer's stay in Central States wasn't particularly long, although he did have a match against Ric Flair at Memorial Hall on April 19th, so when Flair was still the champion. And he was having trouble with some others, such as Crazy Luke Graham, and portraying something of an anti-hero babyface, which, in thinking about it, and obviously the one that most people would, if you say name an anti-hero in wrestling, well, today seems to be Kevin Owens, although he seems to be more of a pure babyface lately. But Stone Cold Steve Austin, circa 1997 through 2001, is kind of the classic version of that. But Sawyer here seems to be portraying a very similar character, because it's just playing off his normal nuttiness, but he's basically fighting the guys that the fans don't like. And that's the way it was going to be. And here he actually surprises me, because he's actually a very accomplished amateur wrestler. And he mat wrestling. By the way, he's facing off against a fellow by the name of Dave Austin. No relation to Steve Austin, of course. But he's got no cage match link or anything, so I have absolutely nothing to say about him. Gut-wrench suplex by Sawyer, and he actually pulls the man up at two, so he's not quite done. And we see Crazy Luke Graham saunter his way down to ringside. And back in those days, when dudes didn't have music, you didn't have all these distractions. You just kind of walk around the ring, and sometimes you just walk to the back, and then other times you get involved. Now, Graham and Sawyer had a match at the Kemper Arena in Kansas City, which is the big arena there. Back in the late 80s, they actually hosted the NCAA Final Four in 1988, which was won by the University of Kansas. I don't know if it had more to do with the fact that they had kind of a de facto home court advantage, or the fact that Danny Manning was a hell of a college player that year. But Of course, that's a much more infamous wrestling venue for being the site of Owen Hart's death at Over the Edge 1999. There's a six-man that they refer to on the broadcast here, but the six-man was actually on March 4th at Kemper that I don't know. I don't know if the date now is labeled wrong, but I'm not going to worry too much about this because sometimes the information for a Central States isn't all that accurate. Sixth man was actually Buzz Sawyer, Wahoo McDaniel, and the Junkyard Dog in from Mid-South against the Road Warriors and Crazy Luke Graham. So quite a bit of star power in that match with Wahoo up from the Carolinas. Sawyer with a snap power slam, one of the absolute best in the business. I know I usually rate it on the Ted DiBiase scale, but after seeing Sawyer more and more, I'm starting to rethink maybe I should call it the Buzz Sawyer scale, except for the fact that most people tend to know Ted DiBiase, so it's a little bit more relatable. I should probably hold off on my love letter for Buzz Sawyer because I actually have notes for a show that I can just record at any time. I like to keep something like that as a kind of break glass in case of emergency thing. It's a WCW, or excuse me, I don't know if it's NWA or WCW Power Hour from January of 1990 from Johnson City, Tennessee, which featured a six-man, Buzz Sawyer, the Great Muta, and the Dragon Master against Arn Anderson, Ric Flair, and Sting with one of the hottest crowds you'll ever see. And Buzz Sawyer, certainly very integral to that, although I think it was that the fans were very much into the Four Horsemen as they were constituted with Sting. And that snap power slam did pick up the three count, if I didn't mention it earlier. And now we get a brawl after the match that goes pretty back and forth between Graham and Buzz Sawyer. And some good stuff until I look closely, and again, The ring is not very well lit, so sometimes you don't notice things the way you would if you're watching a Superstars taping from 1989 or something like that. Sawyer's got one knee pad on, and I'm wondering, is he doing that so that a knee drop will be more effective? And apparently, I thought back into the match, no, he was not dropping any knees on anybody. It's not like he's putting the GTS on somebody and like pulled it down or took it off or whatever. I don't know. Maybe I'm just looking for things to bother me with this. But hey, it's another Buzz Sawyer match in the books, and I like it more and more every time I see it.
Count of two, three, that's it. And hold on, hold on. Here comes Luke Graham and Sawyer and Graham both going at it. Hammer and tongs. Wait a minute. Sawyer and Graham both going back and forth, carrying this feud on. We've got pandemonium in the ring right now. We've got to get some kind of order restored.
Go back to the promo area, and because this is a St. Louis TV station, we're going to do the ad for the Kiel Auditorium show coming up on March the 30th. I mean, there is a war to be fought in St. Louis over the wrestling audience. Some people are going to go with the WWF, and others are going to stay loyal to the NWA, more of a pure wrestling product. They are definitely involved with the American Wrestling Association, who are sending guys down to St. Louis because Bobby Heenan's name is prominently mentioned every single time they are promoting this card. But what's interesting to me is they have a fellow by the name of T.G. Stone there. He's going to be facing off with against the Fabulous Ones, along with a tag team partner that he's going to be talking about, is when Stewart runs down what's going to be on the card, they make the guy who's about to give comments just stand there the entire time, like pacing either next to him or standing there awkwardly where they have to like wring their hands or whatever. Like, really? These guys just can't come in off screen? I mean, that's a pretty obvious production value that the WWF kind of implemented on that with Mean Gene Okerlund, like, come on in, Iron Sheik. But instead, T.G. Stone has to kind of stand there awkwardly for 50 seconds before he gets to say this. And
let me tell you something, Mr. Announcer. I thrilled the audience, the fans, and especially the ladies of St. Louis when I was last there. They're in for a treat. I'm coming back. This time, I've got a big surprise for them. I'm bringing back with me one of the most muscular, one of the most powerful, one of the best wrestlers in the world of professional wrestling today, Don White. He's coming in as my tag team partner against the Fabulous Ones. The Fabulous Ones. Now, let me tell you, I've heard nothing but good about the Fabulous Ones. They've got a great reputation. A great reputation. They come to the ring in all types of paraphernalia, looking every kind of which way. But they're going to go down bad and soon and fast and hard to the great Don White and the pretty one, T.G. Stone.
Just to give you an idea, because you may not be familiar with T.G. Stone, he reminds me like of Greg Valentine's less successful younger brother, sprinkled with a great deal of influence of Buddy Landell for whatever reason, because the look is kind of somewhere between Valentine and Landell. But yeah, the fact that he was standing there, it's almost like he sort of lost his train of thought, you know, the let me tell you something and all that. So we got Crazy Luke Graham there, and he's going to be part of yet another six-man tag. It's the Blackjacks, Lanza, and Mulligan teaming up with Bruce Reed, who is more commonly known as Hacksaw Butch Reed, a very common star in the Central States promotion. And Graham is teaming up with Ken Patera and Jerry Blackwell, so they are down from the AWA. But I guess there's a reason why they call him Crazy Luke Graham, eh?
Let me tell you something. I don't have to talk about my partners, Crusher Blackwell and Patera, because everybody knows their reputation. And I don't have to talk about Blackjack Mulligan and Blackjack Lanzer, because everybody knows they're a great team. One that I want to talk about is myself and this super black star, Bruce Reed. Well, let me tell you something. I don't care if you're Bruce Lee reincarnated. I don't care anything about you. You all swelled up. There's something wrong with you. You got lumps on your body, great big old arms, and your chest is all swelled up. Well, I'm going to let some of the hot air out of you. I'm going to key in on you, Bruce. I'm going to key in on you and show you the wrath of Luke Graham, the crazy Luke Graham. It's going to be crazy Luke Graham. I don't care how much the people holler crazy Luke, because I'm going crazy in there. I'm going to take the hot air out of you, Bruce. And if you get in the way, Mulligan, hey, and Lanzer, the other team will take care of you. I just want the black superstar myself in a corner anywhere, Brucey.
That was pretty manic. And I know what manic is because I was nicknamed Manic Pete in college because we had two Pete's on the floor and the other one was Sneaky Pete, so they just dubbed me Manic Pete. But boy, a lot to digest there. I did like how he referred to one of the Blackjacks as Blackjack Lanzer. Makes him kind of sound like me a little bit. But he seems to be very hung up on the fact that Bruce Reed, Butch Reed, is black. I'm not sure what the deal is, but then again, I realized this is the Kansas City promotion, and your biggest star is named Race, so clearly anybody who comes through there is going to be hung up on race.
Franz Perkins looks like he's
Jordan again.
Michael Jordan again.
He altered that shot. Not a good shot.
Wow. Screened him out, and Alford came out of the ball.
Now, see, Alford's trying to get the foul. He does it. What a great play by Steve Alford.
When you think of Michael Jordan's college basketball career, the first thing you think of is him winning the national title with that shot in 82. But his junior year is last year, 84. They get upset in the NCAA tournament in the round of 16 by Indiana. Indiana is a kind of a powerhouse school. I don't know why I keep doing Indiana-based stuff here with this and the Colts. But they only had two guys make it to the NBA. Indiana did. Steve Alford and this other guy, Huey Blab. Meanwhile, the North Carolina Tar Heels that year had, I don't want to say it was a dream team, but they were definitely very much hyped, led by Michael Jordan. Sam Perkins was a senior that year as well. He had one of the greatest nicknames in sports history, Big Smooth. Brad Daugherty, he went number one overall in 86. And Kenny Smith, who's a freshman, probably the fourth best player on that team, he's a solid NBA player for years and years. Of course, everybody knows him now from being on TNT with Barkley, but he was integral to the two Houston Rockets championships in the mid-90s. So just goes to show Michael Jordan needed to, you know, get upset and lose a time or two to either Indiana or the Pistons in the NBA before he would go on and win six NBA titles over an eight-year span. So coming up next, we have Colonel Buck Robley taking on Paul Kelly. This is not the Paul Kelly who was the National Hockey League Players Association director for like 3 months, and then they kicked him out under mysterious circumstances. This is just some job guy that I don't really know anything about. Colonel Buck Robley. Now, I don't want to go too far into finding out how he became a colonel. I just want to give a shout out to anybody who listens to this podcast who English is their second language, because I was thinking about the word colonel and not necessarily just the military rank, but how screwy and weird the English language is, where the word colonel, you ask somebody who, you know, is learning English, how do you spell colonel? K-E-R, well, no, that's like a kernel of popcorn. I'm talking colonel like the army rank. K, blah, blah, blah. No, it's C-O-L-O-N-E-L. That's how colonel is spelled? I mean, talk about a word that tells you just how screwy the English language is. So I think all I'm saying is, for people who are learning English and coming into this country, just because you grew up with it, let's not lose sight of the fact that learning English is pretty friggin' hard. One of the things I'm constantly fascinated by in following baseball is player comparisons from one to the other, even across eras. I know baseballreference.com has a metric where it's on a scale of 0 to 1,000 how two players are similar. And when I look at Colonel Buck Robley and just kind of everything that I've learned about him, he seems awfully similar to Ole Anderson from several different perspectives, kind of a crusty, crotchety sort of guy who was well respected in the places that he worked, but maybe didn't get along with everybody all the time, except that Buck Robley seemed to be a little bit more liked than Ole. And Robley passed away in 2013, so you're not going to be seeing any shoot interviews where he just proclaims to hate absolutely everything about professional wrestling the way that Ole does. He's a creature, Robley, of the territories, and he was not a politician by any means. So he kind of earns my respect from that perspective. He kind of did what he wanted. He was very instrumental when he was in Mid-South for the creation of the Junkyard Dog and sort of letting Bill Watts know that, yeah, if you push this guy, he is going to deliver. And, of course, the record sort of speaks for itself in the early 80s at JYD in Mid-South. Another person instrumental in Mid-South was Ted DiBiase, and he had some very good things to say about Buck Robley on his website on his passing in 2013. And DiBiase said, then in Atlanta, when Jim Barnett was mad at me for voicing my opinion about a certain booker at the time, it was Buck Robley who was brought in to book Atlanta. It was Buck who saved my bacon when Jim wanted to let me go. It was Buck who came up with the angle I did with the Freebirds on Atlanta TV that people still talk about. That would be the pile driver on the floor. Yes, we who knew Buck know how rough around the edges he was. But we all know very well he knew our business. I just want to say here one last time, thanks, Buck, for all you did to help me become a good wrestler. But more than that, I pray that you truly rest in peace. Well, it kind of sounds like The Undertaker there at the end, but Ted DiBiase, nice little tribute to Colonel Buck Robley. As Rick Stewart lets us know, and I hate when this happens, when I pick a specific show, oh, I pick March 10th, and he lets us know, oh, Tommy Rich is coming in next week. Not that I'm any huge fan of Tommy Rich, but he's somebody that I have a little bit more perspective on than, say, a Ted Oates. So I guess we got to, now that Tommy Rich is coming in, we should keep him away from Buzz Sawyer. But in actuality, it's just that a Tommy Rich match was going to be on the program sent in from another territory. So it's kind of like the Kerry Von Erich thing we had earlier. And Robley, he just gives no craps here. He's biting the face of Paul Kelly. They also let us know that Tiger Mask will be around. Now, don't be fooled. This is not any of the good Tiger Masks from Japan. I have absolutely no earthly idea why they thought it was a good idea to put someone like Ken Wayne under a mask and call him that, but it was a popular gimmick in the early to mid-80s, and I guess, well, just put on the mask. People are going to be out there for the mask, and I'm just glad that that sort of, you know, stealing of a mask gimmick seems to have ended there. I'm glad nobody went out and, you know, called themselves Psychosis 2 or Jushin Liger 2 and wore that mask. As cool as they are, I'm glad that it did not happen. Kind of a boring armbar on the mat by Robley, but then he hits a swinging neck breaker, which looked quite good. and then a pile driver towards the hard camera, Buck Robley letting us know how knowledgeable he is about the business and will not have to spend 3 years in NXT. Although, now that I think about it, that joke is starting to go under, because if NXT is going to be on USA, it's pretty much now going to divide NXT into two, where if you need to learn how to work, I guess you're going to just be working that Florida loop. I don't know if they're going to have a true developmental at a certain point. Anyway, that was just a kind of an aside. Does not go for the pin, which I thought was strange, but he chucks Kelly to the outside and kind of does the King of the Mountain spot a couple of times. And I've mentioned this before, and I probably should, you know, explain what exactly I mean by it. The King of the Mountain spot was something that was fairly common during the MSG house show matches in the late 70s and early 80s, where usually the heel would throw the babyface out to the floor and wouldn't let him come back into the ring. So the role is kind of reversed here, and I'm not saying that Buck Robley is, you know, telling the New York territory that he's ready to come in, because believe me, New York was calling just about anybody they could think of in 1984 as part of that national expansion in the various waves that they had. Now, he has something on his forearm, Robley does, and he goes to load it up, a very interesting move for a babyface. Maybe he's Lex Luger 9 years ahead of time. Maybe Colonel Buck Robley is a true American that Lex Luger turned out to maybe not be. He hits that forearm on Kelly, and he picks up the three count there. I made a note on this match that I really wish that they utilized the second camera a lot more. And I'm saying that as somebody who gets extremely annoyed on WWF programming with the production, WWE programming. Oh, excuse me. I'm living in the past here. I accidentally called it the World Wildlife Fund. When they do the cuts to the ringside cameras and they're zooming in and out, I hate that so friggin' much. However, on the flip side, if I'm going to watch something from one camera view, the hard camera, it better be something like that Flair Steamboat match from Landover, Maryland in 1989, where it's just kind of focused on the action with no commentary. But yeah, Buck Robley, maybe if I see a little bit more of him, maybe he'll get the Buzz Sawyer treatment.
You know, you got one thing right. It's the greatest card ever put together in St. Louis, Missouri. And you know why? Because the grapplers are on that card. That's right, people. Everybody in St. Louis, Missouri knows. I don't have to stand up here and brag about it or talk about it, because everybody knows we're the greatest tag team in the sport of professional wrestling today, and we're the greatest tag team that's ever came to St. Louis, Missouri. Now, they're telling us that we got Les Fortin, the man of 1,001 holes. He knows them all. And we got Ted Oates. He's a man that was here years ago or a while back and had a big reputation around this area. Well, Ted Oates, I want to tell you something, boy. Big reputations don't mean nothing to us. Matter of fact, that was in the past. That was history. That was way back here. Now we're in St. Louis, Missouri. You boys get ready, because the grapplers are coming out for a win. Beat us if you can.
That was the mass team of the grapplers talking about their upcoming match at the Kiel Auditorium on the 30th. And they're wearing normal clothes, which I love, with the mask guy. And grappler number one, who is Len Denton, is wearing a plaid shirt, which I was going to say is a lot like me, but I haven't really been wearing plaid shirts the last probably year and a half quite as frequently as I used to. The other grappler who doesn't get to talk is actually the future Dirty White Boy, Tony Anthony, who we met in the Continental episode that I did, episode 88 of Greetings from Allentown. Do check that out in the archives. It, beat us if you can, survive if we let you. But seriously, they actually would win the tag team titles in the month of April. First, the Oates brothers had beaten them for the vacant title, and then the following week, they actually captured the title themselves, the Grapplers. And then later in 1984, they had a little back-and-forth exchange of the titles with a team of Marty Jannetty and Tommy Rogers. And not that Tommy Rogers. We're actually going to meet who that is coming up in just a little bit. But it's going back and forth. The name of that team of Jannetty and Rogers was called the Uptown Boys, which all I can think of is, because that Billy Joel song had just come out the year before, all I can think is, Uptown Boys, you know the lady's gonna make some noise. I'm not going to go any further because I don't want to disrespect Billy Joel. I was kind of hoping I would be able to go to the show at Fenway Park, but Now, those secondary market tickets for Billy Joel at Fenway are insane. It's like $180. Like, how the hell did I go see Springsteen at Fenway for like $75 back in 2012? Is like the market corrected that? Like, I don't understand what the hell is going on. But anyway, back to the, you know, grapplers. You know, they say their piece there. And like I mentioned before, every single time they have one of these stand-up interviews, they make the wrestlers, in this case, both of them, stand there as Rick Stewart does the, you know, reciting of everything that's going to be on the card. I mean, let me just give you an idea of how long it is that he's going with it.
At 7:30, fans in St. Louis are in for the largest card of professional wrestling ever in the Gateway City. No increase in prices. St. Louis Wrestling Club at the Kiel Auditorium. 25 of the world's greatest wrestlers, including Dick Slater, Bobby the Brain Heaton, and several more matches to be announced later next week here on All-Star Wrestling. Already signed by the NWA. Six-man tag. Blackjack Mulligan, Blackjack Lanza, and Bruce Reed take on Crusher Blackwell, Ken Patera, and Crazy Luke Graham. Jim Garvin and Precious return to St. Louis to battle Chris Adams. Hacksaw Dugan faces the 6'7", 300-pound one-man gang. Dick the Bruiser returns to St. Louis to battle 6'4", 250-pound Cy Jurgensen. The Fabulous Ones, in their Gateway City debut, take on Don White and T.G. Stone. Plus, the World Junior Heavyweight Champion Les Thornton and Ted Oates team up to meet the masked grapplers. Get your advance tickets at the Kiel Auditorium box office, All Famous Fire Stores, Regal Sports, Team, Togs, and Tickets. Or you can make your telephone reservations by calling Dial-Tix at 644-1700. The largest card of wrestling ever in St. Louis. Ted Oates and the world's junior champion Les Thornton against the sensational masked grapplers.
I really feel like chyrons and graphics, however crude and primitive they might have been, certainly would have helped that guy. I mean, they could have shaved time off of this and given more to really anything else. I know you're trying to promote the show in St. Louis, and maybe you just need time to fill, but it just struck me as weird to make the wrestlers pace around on camera. Just like I said earlier, have them wait off camera. They're facing the team of Ted Oates and Les Thornton. I'm like, Thornton and Oates? Where have I seen that before? Like, oh yeah, that's right. They're the two great Bruins centers who never crossed for the Boston Bruins. And Adam Oates shot his way out of town in 1997, ripping his teammates in front of the general manager, which feels like a terrible idea. And then they lost probably about 20 out of the last 25 games after they traded him, which led to them getting the number one pick. And that was Joe Thornton. So, it's nice to see a Thornton and an Oates actually get together. So for our final match, we have Crazy Luke Graham. And I'm wondering, was he named Crazy because of something he did specifically, or was he named Crazy and it was just self-fulfilling prophecy? He's facing off against the Tommy Rogers, who was teaming up in the Uptown Boys with Marty Jannetty, which another way that was an interesting team is Marty Jannetty, of course, known for being part of the Rockers with Shawn Michaels, a team that formed right in the Kansas City territory. But Tommy Rogers would actually go on become Tommy Lane as one half of the Rock and Roll RPMs, who we saw in a Memphis episode a while back. So here are two guys that were on Rock and Roll Express knockoff teams with extremely different levels of success. The RPMs, I guess, maybe had a little, you know, here and there down in the South, but the Rockers, one of the great tag teams in WWF history, probably the greatest one that never held the tag team titles. Now, Crazy Luke Graham, he actually knew what it was like to hold what was then the WWF's tag team titles. It was referred to as a U.S. tag team title, and he held it as part of the Graham Brothers with Dr. Jerry Graham back in 1964 and 65. So this guy has clearly been around a while, wrestling during the Johnson administration in the New York territory. During this match, they allude to all the Grahams being related. Like, those two Grahams are related to Eddie Graham, who's related to Mike Graham. Now, Eddie and Mike are father and son. But now, superstar Billy Graham is related to all of them is very, very confusing. But I think only Eddie and Mike are actually related. Graham also notable for having one knee pad, so maybe he has Buzz Sawyer's one that is missing. He has it on his left knee, and you're not going to get anything dynamic from him because this guy wrestled in the 1960s. You're not going to see, at the risk of sounding like Gorilla Monsoon, you're going to see a flying head scissors, a figure four leg locks, or short arm scissors. I always go back to the short arm scissors. He tosses Rogers to the outside right away. And from the apron, he slams him back in as Rick Stewart lets us know of an important TV match coming up that he's going to let us know what that is. I'm like, cripes, I missed that by a week? And I'm just waiting to find out what it is. Like, oh yeah, Ric Flair is coming in and we're going to have him facing whoever. But thankfully, it wasn't quite to that level. Graham slams Rogers onto the top rope, kind of hot-shotting him in that way. And Rogers does fight back, but really not much going on there. I don't think Luke Graham feels like selling for Tommy Rogers. It's not exactly the most exciting stuff here. But what's interesting to me is that Luke Graham hits an atomic drop, the Bob Backlund-style atomic drop, and that actually picks up the win. So take that, Backlund. You can still use this as a finisher in 1984, apparently. But on the flip side, having a guy win via that atomic drop, which not as powerful as the Backlund one where he would actually run across the ring, perhaps a sign that Kansas City had fallen behind the times as a territory. And I hate to assign that much to one single enhancement match, but maybe this match is kind of defining that Kansas City had just fallen behind and did not have any chance of catching up. So, all right, you're going to have a big match next week. I'm not doing a Greetings from Allentown on the March 17th show. Tell us what it is, Rick Stewart.
And, of course, we said we have a very special announcement concerning next week's TV card, and here it is. A little bit earlier this hour, you saw the problems that continue to go on between popular young Ron Ritchie and the masked team of the Grapplers. Well, Ron Ritchie has issued the challenge, and he's found himself a partner. So next week, here on TV for All-Star Wrestling, you'll see Ron Ritchie and his new partner, the sensational Ted Oates, team up to take on the masked grapplers. And I can't think of any four men who'll provide a more exciting match. And the bad blood between Ritchie and the grapplers promises that this match will be fireworks from the word go. I can't help but think back to the times when Ron Ritchie is laid in the middle of the ring.
Just figured I would spice it up a little bit by playing the shopping round music from Wheel of Fortune at that time. So this Ron Ritchie against the grapplers, this must be the thing that was cut from the video, because there's no, it's a 35-minute video, so clearly there's about 7 or 8 minutes that's missing. And I searched all over to see if I could piece together the beginning of this show with that, but apparently not. So I'm not saying that everything here has just been a great mess, but I'm glad that I was able to figure out, you know, that there probably was something for that first 6 or 7 minutes. But yeah, all right, Ron Ritchie and Ted Oates against the Grapplers, fine. That's going to be on some other show that I'm not reviewing. I don't, you know what? I'm not going to be mad about that anymore, okay? Because that is the end of Central States All-Star Wrestling for March 10th, 1984. However, I will say this, they do have a pretty cool outro theme.
The hard-hitting action continues with All-Star Wrestling 2, next on KDNL TV Channel 30.
Now, you're wondering why Vince McMahon was able to run roughshod over these other territories? For cripes sakes, their B-show they decided to call All-Star Wrestling 2. You couldn't come up with another name to call it? Everything was All-Star Wrestling or Championship Wrestling. And I know even the WWF had, you know, their shows, but they didn't call All-Star Wrestling and All-Star Wrestling 2. I mean, that is the height of laziness and lack of creativity. I said, you wonder why these guys ended up going out of business. Although Central States did hang around for a little bit longer than some of the other ones. But, oh boy. But still, pretty cool tune.
We got down, we got up, we got funky, and we got bad.
Indeed we did, Mr. Cal Rudman. And that's an appropriate way, I think, to wrap up Central States All-Star Wrestling number 1 from March 10th, 1984. Before Before I go into the podcast plugs for this week, just to give an update, since I started recording this show, apparently Pro Wrestling Only Feed has met its goal for the SoundCloud feed for the upcoming year. I want to thank everybody who donated to that effort, particularly listener Sean Emily, who had a particularly large donation, or at least as pointed out by Kelly on the WorldCast Twitter feed. So thank you to all who donated, either large, little, or somewhere in between. It allows you to bring you shows like this, Bigfoot Pro Wrestling Podcast, Days of Thunder, WorldCast, Military Industrial Suplex, there's so many more. Strong Style Story, I probably forgot one or two, but it's not like I can't stretch this out, because I'm only at an hour 9 right now, and this is much shorter than any show I've done recently, but enough about that. In other podcasts, my pals, if you will, I'll be recording the Adams Division podcast with Steve Bennett. Probably as this show is dropping, we're actually going to be recording it for our favorite single-season sports teams not over the last 25 years, but I guess it would kind of fit the profile, although I think more than a couple of mine will be from the 80s, so it'll be longer than that time frame. So be on the lookout for that on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed on the Our Vantage Point podcast with Joe Morata and Michael Quinn. They are looking at a September 1996 WCW Prime show in which I express great sadness because I don't want to review the same thing as them too close to when they did it. And I think it's time for me to do another WCW Prime. For those of you, I know that there are people who have those videos of WCW Prime. They're not showing up on YouTube and Daily Motion. Could you reach out to me via Twitter or via greetingsballantine@gmail.com? Because I'm going to want to do a WCW Prime over the next couple of episodes. A couple of catches, though. It's got to have Chris Cruz and Dusty Rhodes as the announcers. That's really all I ask. I should probably look at the listings so I can be a little bit more specific on that. Now, on the wrestling podcast About Nothing with Ring of Honor's Brian Brawler Malonis and Mike Crockett, who I may be seeing on Friday, more on that in a second, they have Brian Fury, the owner of Chaotic Wrestling Inn, and he is discussing the upcoming New England Pro Wrestling Academy Fantasy Camp that is actually happening this Saturday, which would be the day after Chaotic Wrestling's Summer Chaos show up in Haverhill, Massachusetts, which I will be attending with Keithy, and it should be a lot of fun. You know, I don't think Mike Crockett is going to be there because they're not going to be handing out pizza slices at the door. Apparently, there was something back at Astromania in March with Crockett eating a lot of pizza. Kind of didn't sit well with a lot of people, not the least of which was Brian Malonis, as I understand it anyway, just kind of hearing through the grapevine on that. But I'm very excited for that show, even though I know Keithy is probably going to take too many hits off his vape pen and he's going to ask me if I want one, and I'm going to have to say all the while reminding him that I do need to maintain a position where I could take a drug test at a moment's notice with my job search and all of that, but mainly because I don't think vaping is for me. Like I said, I think that should be consumed either. I'll let you have it in brownies or via edibles, but the big Bob Marley joints, like I said, like the thing in Caddyshack that I played a couple weeks ago, I think that's the way it should be consumed. But it should be a good time. I'm very excited to see the main event of Retro AG Anthony Green defending the Chaotic title against Killanova. That should be quite the matchup, headlining Chaotic's biggest show of the summer. But wait a minute, I actually have one thing I can go to here to wrap up the show. I just realized that I had not done it for this week, and that I actually have the material at hand for YouTube Comment Theater. Now, this is actual YouTube comments made by what I presume are actual users. I don't think Russian bots make... you know what? I shouldn't say anything, because if you look at like those conspiracy videos, I would assume somebody is stirring the pot there. So let's just take these at face value for what they are. And we'll start out with Joseph Pomar says, Lucas Graham is one of my idols, Daddy. Now, I've never heard Luke Graham referred to as Lucas Graham. I don't think he's very big on formality, considering that his name is Crazy Luke Graham. Purple Rambler 69 says, "Wow, does Von Erich look messed up?" Like, well, that could be kind of a standing headline when it applies to Kerry. As Will in Chicago says, "Amen, that sunset flip at the end was a joke." I said, yeah, he went over three quarters. It was not particularly attractive, but it's kind of how it is with Kerry Von Erich for quite a period of time. Sir Belvedere says, "I really miss the territories. Today's wrestling is nothing but poop emoji." Well, there's the one that you see in every YouTube comment from a territory show video. Dynamo 805 says, "Since the promos are for the 330-84 Kiel Auditorium card, would this be the episode that aired 317-84? And I'm not playing that game where I question what the date is from. I looked at other sites, and it does seem to be the March 10th show. Sasquatch says, "The best fans are the old ladies who grew up watching it on Saturdays in the 50s and 60s. Some of them are rabid fans, LOL. It's nice to see that some small-time family feel with the fans." Yeah, you'd be hard-pressed to find old women in the front row at either a WWE or an AEW show when those you start seeing those in earnest in October. Go Modley says, "These numbnuts ever heard of TV lights? Christ." I mean, yeah, it was pretty dark on this, but it's not as if a lot of the territories put a great emphasis on TV lighting until you get to a couple of years after this. Clarence Worley says, "Memorial Hall is in Kansas City, Kansas," and that is actually where I learned that the arena was on the Kansas side of the river. Seth H. 1982 says, "Anyone know what song Kerry uses here to come to the ring? It isn't his usual Tom Sawyer." Yes. Is actually Sammy Hagar. That much was... I can't believe I didn't recognize Sammy Hagar's voice right off the jump. And that's Hagar prior to Van Halen. Barry Waller says, "Ted Oates here looks like a cross between Ted DiBiase and Jack Briscoe." I'm not so sure about that. I mean, he was okay, but I'm not going to put him in that kind of rarefied air. Barry Waller also comments, "Neither Bill Mercer nor Mark Lorenz gets the credit he deserves for making world-class championship wrestling in Dallas glory years a very entertaining vehicle." You know, and I'm not going to read the rest of this because it's about world-class and it's just the one match that's on here. Native Sun says, "Referees Sonny Myers and Brocco Lubitsch would make one hell of a foot race." And yes, I did not comment on the referee for the Kansas City matches, but Sonny Myers kind of went down to one knee to make a count, and which Brocco Lubitsch would do in world class. It would be fun to see those two guys in a 100-meter dash. I mean, you could probably measure the times that they ran using a sundial. I know that kind of sounds like a Jim Cornette joke or something that he would make. But anyway, that's enough for YouTube comment theater. For next week's show, I'm going to do something a little bit different because I usually cover a one-hour program, and occasionally I've done it, the hour and a half Saturday Night's Main Event and the two-hour Raw for episode 100, but I'm going to go back to 1991, and you may have seen this on my Twitter at GF Allentown Pod, and be sure to give it a follow if you don't want to miss something like this, where I asked which show from August 1991 WWF would make for a better Greetings from Allentown episode, with the two choices, the SummerSlam Spectacular from August 18th, airing 8 days prior to SummerSlam, or the Primetime Wrestling from August 12th, 6 days before that, with the Macho Man Randy Savage's Bachelor Party. And with 57% of the vote, the winner was the Primetime Wrestling with the Macho Man Randy Savage's Bachelor Party. And I can't wait to cover that because, just a discussion of bachelor parties, maybe I'll have an anecdote or two from my own bachelor party when I was rendered and forced to play Edward 40 Hands when I had already had plenty to drink. Going out to, well, you know what, I shouldn't just give the whole thing away here. I mean, to the Macho Man Randy Savage Bachelor Party, in which all rules of kayfabe were broken because you had faces and heels at this thing. Kind of tells you how popular Savage was, reaching across those lines. But then again, in 1991, they kind of threw all that out the window when they had the WrestleMania History and Heroes, and Slick is just standing next to the Bushwhackers, who are also next to Jimmy Hart, and like nothing happens. Actually, my problem from that was Greg Valentine being so close to Jimmy Hart so quickly after their breakup. I don't know, but that's enough for me. But please be sure to give a 5-star review for Greetings from Allentown on the iTunes / Apple Music review portal, whatever the hell you want to call it. That is definitely appreciated because it provides what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this particular podcast. And also, be a dear and do the same for the Pro Wrestling Only feed as well. 5 stars, definitely appreciated for that as well. I thank you so much for listening, and tune in next time for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
I just want the black superstar myself in a corner anywhere, Brucey.